Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney Show. I hope you're all having a great night out there. If you would like to call in, this is an open lines, anything goes show. The number to call is area code 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. It's 855-346-3351. Okay, let's see. Where do we even start? So many things going on. One of the things that I stumbled over today, if I can get my computer to work. See, I knew this was going to happen. Too much going on, not enough memory. Is a report from the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. And this report is titled, let's see. Well, you can get it at NASHBID.org. It's N-A-S, www.NASMHPD.org, and then /publications/, with spaces in between each word, it seems, the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals technical report, report_July_2014.pdf. And my computer is freezing on me. But essentially, it's the vital role here of state hospitals. If you'd like to call in and talk, I'd so like to be able to have my computer work to let you into the conversation. Wow, live radio, folks, just remember that when I'm trying to open up, everything is freezing. So anyway, there's a report that is seemingly supporting the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals coming from the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. And this, of course, does not make any sense. It's not in line with things that you would think would come through. And if you're trying to get through right now and call in, you can call in at area code 267-521-0167. 267-521-0167. And I just can't get into my studio, so I'm going to have to crash down my whole program and hope that when it opens up again that it will all be there and working. So let's see, what else can we talk about? Well, I can talk about I can read to you the response that came from John Allen, John B. Allen Jr., president of the National Association of Consumer Survivor and Mental Health Administrators, while I wait for my computer to maybe reload and work again. So it's on letterhead, apparently, the National Association of Consumer Survivor and Mental Health Administrators, 44 Holland Avenue, 8th floor, Albany, New York, 12229, and has been mentioned elsewhere. That is also the New York State Office of Mental Health. And the 8th floor is the, quote-unquote, executive floor of the Office of Mental Health. So, anyway, this letter from John B. Allen, Jr., president of the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators, says, this report recognizes some of the contributions that recipients and families have made to promote the concepts of recovery and the integration of individuals with mental health issues into broader society. Many of us who have received services from the state institutions hold a variety of strong feelings about our experiences. in parentheses, some good, but many involving real and slash or perceived injustices, end parentheses, in those institutions which still drive our advocacy efforts today. Most of us found in those experiences real connections with the men and women who work in those institutions, which provided the basis for hope and sustained our humanity at some of the lowest points of our lives. This is the preface response or setup or introduction from John B. Allen, Jr., president of the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators, in the report on the vital role of psychiatric hospitals, published by the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors in July of 2014. So John Allen concludes in this letter, seeming support, to those men and women who worked in housekeeping, food service, maintenance, management, clinical, and other roles, who engaged us as valuable human beings, who nurtured our sense of hope and possibility, and who helped us endure and recover, we wish to recognize your work and thank you for your efforts. Sincerely, John B. Allen, Jr., President, National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators. So that's the letter, and that's on page 3 of the report, which can be found on the NASHBID website. Along with this is also a opening letter from Bob Glover, and the table of contents includes the executive summary, an introduction, a history and current context of state psychiatric hospitals. I can't wait to read this report. How states use psychiatric hospitals, the use of public, general, and local hospitals, the environment and culture of state psychiatric hospitals, and then it's got all kinds of stuff about recovery, trauma-informed care, reducing seclusion and restraint. You know, in 1999, it was eliminating seclusion and restraint, so how we got to reducing... Of course, I almost got fired for suggesting we should say elimination. The vital role of peer support services. Why the hell is this what they're calling? Okay, executive summary. This technical report is advocacy for state psychiatric hospitals to be a vital part of the continuum of recovery sources. Live radio. This technical report is advocacy for state psychiatric hospitals to be a vital part of the continuum of recovery services that should be integrated with a robust set of community services. If you're out there and you'd like to talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Okay. So recommendations are provided, this is a quote, recommendations are provided for improving community integration, state psychiatric hospital services and operations, and policies on all system levels. The report is not advocacy for increasing state psychiatric hospitals or beds. But it is advocacy for state psychiatric hospitals to be a vital part of the continuum of recovery services. So to support and justify the recommendations, the report includes background and discussion on the history and current context of state psychiatric hospitals, data and trends, how admission decisions to state psychiatric hospitals are made, and the impact of the 1999 Olmstead Supreme Court decision, financing, the use of technology, and what the environment and culture of state psychiatric hospitals should be. The major findings and messages from the report and recommendations are the following. These are all bullet points. Remember, if you'd like to, hi, I got you coming in. Area code 706, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, it's Jen and Sharon again.
Hey, Jen and Sharon, how are you both?
Good, Lauren. How are you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Thanks for calling back in. That was great conversation starters last night. And so what would you like to talk about tonight?
Well, what you're talking about, well, I took a look at it earlier. And I think, what the hell are peers being clumped into, like maintenance and those many words divided by commas for people, you know, and their jobs? What was the CPS associated with that for?
What associated with what for?
Well, why did the author that wrote that associate the certified peer specialists and peer services and peer supports with that list of other people's jobs who have no bearing on doing peer supports? Although I can see what he was trying to do, but it's flawed and it kind of screws up the whole thing.
You mean, I'm trying to figure out which letter, the letter from John Allen, you mean? The letter from John Allen, so where he says, to those men and women who worked in housekeeping, food service, maintenance, management, clinical, is it that?
Yeah. And what's the association between room service, for instance, and a CPS, what we do? Although, you know, I have to tell you something. It's kind of a war story, okay? The certified peer specialists were first beginning to be employed in the state of Texas, in Texas, one of the first employers was Austin State Hospital and Austin Travis County Integral Care. And I had a friend who was one of the very first peers who got hired. Guess what they hired her to do?
What?
Make coffee in the lobby.
Well, food, filth, and file. That's what we get. Although, if you're in, one of the things that I learned is if you're someplace like in Colorado, they call it food, filth, and flowers, which I thought was fascinating, and a total geographic analysis. this is the problem. This is why I'm so opposed to it. This is why it's not anything that it was intentionally ever supposed to be.
You're already on the line. Oh, hey, Lauren, a friend of mine out of the state of Texas is trying to call in, but she needs the phone number.
Oh, it's area code 267-521-0167. And
yeah,
if you need a toll-free line, it's area code, hang on a second, I don't have that one memorized. It's area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. Toll-free, and 267-521-0167 if you need. If you're on the line, because there are a few people that are online, make sure you press 1 or star 1 so I know to bring you into the conversation.
Thank you, Lauren.
Sure thing. So I think that, you know, I think we're in big trouble, and I think that the more that people go into this thinking that, you know, they'll be able to make whatever, the rationalization, the justification, well, I'll be able to make whatever small changes I'll be able to make that I wouldn't be able to make at all if I wasn't in this job. And that's the kind of, coerced silence, I think, in devoiced, we kept on referring it to it, of where, because of all other things, people are just doing the best that they can do with what they can do and not walking over the line.
You know, my favorite quote is this quote from Mother Teresa, and it basically says that we work for a, hold on, and I'll read it to you. It's all my little signature, my emails. I'm sure you've seen it.
Are you on speakerphone?
Yeah, I'm on speakerphone.
Okay, is there any way that you can, because I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you. And so I just don't know.
Well, no, not really, because there's also Sharon here in the room.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I'll try turning it down. Hold on. Is that better?
That is better.
Okay, good.
Okay, so go ahead.
Okay, so the quote is, "We the willing, led by the unknowing, are doing the impossible for the ungrateful. We've done so much with so little for so long, we're not qualified to do anything with nothing." Mother Teresa. Isn't that fabulous?
The only part I get caught up in is the ungrateful. I don't get that part. But
you know, you have to remember the population she worked with. You know, and I mean, she was in the poorest of the poorest places in the whole wide world, you know, like in Africa. You know, she was a missionary. She was fantastic. And the people that I think she's referring to as ungrateful is sometimes we do provide help to people, and they are that way.
See, but I think that's the whole problem with help.
Only because that's just where they're at. You know, that's just where they're at.
Right, but I think that's part of the whole problem about help. And that's why so many people are opposed to the idea of help, and especially help from a quote-unquote peer who isn't allowed to go out and have a cup of coffee with me or whatever.
What do you think of the community health worker pro Madora? But they do similar work in health education and promotion and for, you know, primary care, for public health.
I have a lot of really unpopular beliefs. What can I tell you, Jen? I don't want the government involved, and I think that the more that we get the government involved, the more we are going to ultimately be prey to the government. And so, I think that education is one thing, but, you know, with the exception of airborne diseases, you don't generally have public health workers coming in, like, banging down the doors of people saying that you must, you know, eat this vegetable or whatever. Like, they're not, it isn't the same thing, so to compare it is really unfair. And I think that, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, there used to be, or there may even still be, but when they were developing what is now called assisted outpatient treatment in New York, the involuntary outpatient commitment law, one of the programs that they modeled it off of was a program of the Department of Health called DOT, which was Delivered Observable Treatment, and it was for people who had airborne diseases, where they would go and make sure that people were taking whatever drugs they were. And so they were originally calling it involuntary outpatient commitment and then had to change it to assisted outpatient treatment. The DOT's model was part of what was in those original conversations inside of the New York State Office of Mental Health when they were arguing out, you know, but the DOH does this. And then it's like, yeah, but that's an airborne disease. And, you know, quote-unquote schizophrenia is not an airborne disease, right? I don't think it's the same. I don't think it's the same thing at all. And I don't think we can compare them, but I think public health has as many issues. But that's not possible.
Hello?
Yeah, so you're still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Sorry, we're having audio problems with the laptop.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
We're trying to see how we can pull you just on the laptop and take you off speakerphone.
So, I don't know if you were able to hear my response or not.
Okay, well, whatever. We were just having audio problems.
Okay.
You know, one, I guess what I have been thinking a lot about lately is how much I really love the work that I do. And I consider it slightly, very, very slightly like my ministry, if you want to use that word to describe the kind of service that I like that I love to do.
Did you say like a ministry?
Yeah, it's like a ministry to me. But it's like an informal ministry.
Informal cult?
No, not at
all. I'm sorry, because sometimes I do see the public health people as like a little bit of a cult. But, you know, that's just, I said, I have very unpopular ideas about these things. Psychiatry okay, well, sometimes calls it psychosis. you know.
I'm starting to experience psychosis here, yeah.
So I think that's part of it. But area code 803, your line is open.
Hi, y'all. This is Gareth.
Hey, Gareth.
Gareth.
Well, I
Gareth.
Just loved the show last night so much I came back. I'm looking at this report about the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals. I'm glad you looked into it. It's very interesting. And it has a lot of really interesting charts and statistics and stuff that are really fascinating. And it's interesting that the expert panel that guided the shaping of this policy report are all people who are administrators of state hospitals. It doesn't seem that they had any kind of stakeholder participation. So it's not surprising that they affirm a vital role for their own employers.
Well, perhaps from their perspective, right. But why is John Allen, who is, you know, supposedly our representative and the representative for the, you know, National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators, saying, you know, thanks to all you great mental health professionals out there, and, you know, if people have perceived injustices, you know, we want to thank those who really did help us, though. And
well, I didn't see specific quotes by John Allen in there. I saw that
it's
was...
It's on page 3.
Page 3?
Yeah.
Okay. But it seemed like he was really outnumbered, number one. All the other ones were administrators of hospitals. And number two, he does work within the system. So what can I say? I don't know him personally. I don't know his work either.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he's the New York State Office of Mental Health Director of Consumer Affairs, who also collects the database of people who get turned into the state for the New York Safe Act to have their guns taken away from them. Not really protecting the values of the psychiatric survivor movement here in New York. And then I think that's a shame, because I do think, quite frankly, he agrees with us. What's that?
Oh, hello. I'm looking at homes in Atlanta. I'm sorry. I forgot I had you on. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Oh, wow. It is on page 3. I see it. There's a signature and everything. It's specifically Okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
I mean, Gareth, I know we have, like, different opinions, and Jen and all, and I think, you know, like, Jen and I've been bouncing around on Facebook for, like, a year now, and I love communicating. But, like, I'm never exaggerating. I'm never pushing the line. I'm never making shit up. Oop, radio. I'm never saying things that aren't, like, absolutely, completely in there as what it is. And very often people think that I'm, like, I am doing that, because what I say sometimes seems so preposterous. And it's like, that can't really be what it is. But it really is.
Oh, well, I take the comment, but I wasn't suggesting any such thing. I just opened the document about 2 minutes ago, because you called my attention to it, and I'm like, holy moly.
Yeah, so I'm just learning about it too, actually. So, yeah. Just, you know, live radio.
Live radio.
As it happens, folks. But, yeah, I mean, I think your point about the fact that the overwhelming majority, if not all of these people, are psychiatric professional workers, doctors, MPAs, psychologists, licensed social workers. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Sure. And so it'll be really interesting. And I guess from an environmental psychology perspective, I'm really interested in how they're going about it, because I don't see any of, like, the fundamental research of environmental psychology that, like, says, you know, psychiatric institutions are bad and they need to be shut down, and that these are places that hurt people. And so I don't see any of that fundamental research that has been going on for 40-plus years in their references. And they have that, like, in their table of contents. They have all this stuff around the environment of the environment and culture of state psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah, this is bringing up bad memories. I'm going to look at the references now.
It just seems odd to me that in, like, 2014, that NASHBID, who is, like, the same organization that, you know, promoted the trauma-informed care stuff, and I guess that that's part of what they're trying to get is that, you know, hospitals should become trauma-informed care-based kinds of things since they have two pages on it, and it's all about pushing pure stuff in institutions. But why are we keeping them as a, quote-unquote, vital role on the quote-unquote continuum? Why are we doing that? And why is the representative for people who are psychiatrically assigned saying, thanks to all of those workers out there who helped us?
Yeah, that's pretty baffling. I have to read this report to learn more about what they're claiming. But that is kind of baffling.
I don't know. If I just want to give the number out again, if people want to call in and have some perspective, 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, and if you need a toll-free line, 855-346-3351. So, I don't know, it is, it's baffling. Baffling is a good word to describe it. Why is this allowable? I mean, but it's the same kind of baffling that I've been trying to figure out is, you know, the New York SAFE Act, which expanded New York's involuntary outpatient commitment law, also included this whole thing about how anybody with a psychiatric history, that their guns were going to be taken away if a doctor thinks that, you know, like if a doctor thinks somebody is unstable, a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist, a social worker, a general practitioner, any of these medical professionals, if in New York they think that somebody is, like, you know, quote-unquote unstable, they call the police then call, you know, the state and find out whether or not they have a gun registered. If they have a gun registered, the state police are sent out to their house to pick up their gun. The person who did the video training for this law to professionals about how to fill out the paperwork to have this process for people to have their gun taken away from them and who actually administers the database of the people who have been reported is John Allen, our Director of Consumer Affairs. And so,
really?
Yeah. And you know, he said it at a meeting once, and I said, well, that's not possible. So I immediately called the Office of Mental Health, and I was like, he's saying he's in charge of this thing. How is that possible? And I was told that it was true and that they don't know how it's possible. And so, that this person didn't know how it was possible.
Get assigned to him. How did that become part of his job? Seems odd.
It's just not what. So when I tell you, like, from a New Yorker's perspective, when they start talking about that we're going to go now add another level of bureaucracy into this, and that we're going to have to be quote unquote certified, and we're going to have to be now quote unquote Medicaid billable, where we've been staving it off so long, but that yet this is what's going on in our office of, you know, quote-unquote consumer affairs. Like, these are where my very real fears for any kind of replication of what's gone on in further formalizing this industry is, you know, it's where it's coming from.
Well, regarding the peer support industry or peer support workers, I think it has pretty much past the tipping point that it is going to continue and grow and get more and more standardized and certified. I think a few years ago, I really didn't know. I had no idea what was going to happen with it. I thought it was an open question. But right now, I think it's past the tipping point and is definitely going to go that direction. So that's my opinion. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but I think that it's coming inevitably.
Yeah. Which is so disturbing. And, you know, they're now accrediting and certifying, you know, quote-unquote peers in New York State now, and there's classes that are being done about them. And it's really, it's just so so problematic. And so, I mean, part of this report of what I'm understanding, and thanks to all you folks who are just texting me stuff and giving me information here to put out, is that part of it, what they're talking about, is that there's a lot of reference to, quote-unquote, peers working in state hospital programs. Someplace it says that that these, you know, peer supporters should have mandatory training for 1 year of working in a state hospital before graduation. Do you think? I mean, I can't even like control myself because that's such a ludicrous idea. For anybody out there who works in this movement, for anybody on the phone, if you were told that in order to have this quote unquote peer job, you need to work in a state hospital for a mandatory 1 year to be observed working as a peer, would you ever go near a state hospital mandatorily ever again for a job? Like, I don't know.
That's how it started in Texas. That's how it started in Texas. It started at Austin State Hospital, for the best of my knowledge, And it's interesting because they have a good number of individuals working in that program, and they've done outstanding work, and at the same time, it's taken its hit because there's been pneumonitis. There have been a lot of losses of lives that have for people that have worked there.
I don't get like what's outstanding. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, are they getting people out of the institution? Is that because
they are? They're working in the acute and forensic adult psychiatric units as well as the children as well as the geriatric units. I mean, well, I did my practicum at Ash, you know. And when I was going to graduate school at UT Austin, and I feel that they are the best provider in the city of Austin.
Well, I guess I don't understand. I guess is the best I can
what
say.
What don't you understand? You don't understand why it's outstanding?
I don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand how anybody can think that being trained in a state hospital.
I don't think they think that. It's an opportunity. I guess the difference may be that for many people that started there, and I know that I got in there not as a peer but as a graduate practicum doing research and practice, that It was like, oh God, I got a job as a CPS. I mean, how exciting is that? It was rare. It was a very rare thing. Now it's very prevalent. I mean, that's when they first started out. You got to bear in mind.
I mean, I guess part of what maybe here's, I don't know, where anybody out there who gets what I'm saying, 267-521-0167. What I'm saying is that like the idea of having to be in an environment of a psychiatric institution and being trained by the psychiatric institution is the last thing.
I was not trained by the psychiatric institution. Okay? I was trained as a peer by Larry Fricks and Ike Powell and Beth Filson on how to do CPS stuff. But when I was there, that was previous to my becoming
CPS,
a
is that
specialist.
Child Protective Services?
Certified peer specialist. I know, it gets really kind of confusing. No.
Certified peer specialist. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, so I mean, like I said, like that's very, I mean, it's just not, it's what happens when our movement got bought out. Like those kinds of things are what happened when our movement, and you know, and quite frankly, I think that all of those people's work, and certainly, like I said the other night, I have a particular, you know, affinity toward, because he was one of the first people I ever got trained by and who I ever did anything with the youth movement in the early 90s, and Beth Stilson, I believe, worked on the trauma-informed peer support guide, right?
What?
Beth Filson is one of the people who worked on the trauma-informed guide for women, the guidebook.
Right,
I
right,
think.
Right. Yeah, Beth.
Right.
Beth,
right.
Beth,
so I mean,
Beth,
so I'm like,
Darby, you know, Darby, you know.
Right, with Darby and Kathy and Andy Blanche, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that, like, maybe I can tell you a story that was told to me through the dissertation research through Devoiced. There was an organization where somebody, where they were having a support group meeting, and the person went and tried to find out about this article that had been written, and everybody was like, oh, we don't know about it. And what happened was that a group of people got together and were able to break somebody out of the psychiatric institution. And then it got written about in the, in the Mental Patients Liberation local newspaper up there. And then somebody read that and found out about it and then went to that place to get involved with them. And so in the 70s, that was what our movement was about. It was about breaking people.
Are you saying that, I guess what I hear you saying, Lauren, is that, I guess it's not a question, it's more of a statement that we've lost our road.
I'm having real trouble hearing you. More of a statement that what?
I said, it seems as if we've lost our path.
As a movement, right, because the industry.
Yeah, right.
The industry took it over. And so multiple generations down, people don't even know what the original work of the movement was because it's been so washed out of everything.
Right. And you know how I feel about this is that, to me, I feel that the work, the services that I can provide and the services that a lot of other people and their interests and they're wanting to do this work, because that's what they want to do. You know, they want to do the service. They want to do the work.
Right, but this wasn't about a job.
Well, hold on. I'm not done saying. There's a lot of us that are consulting doing this now, consulting to providers to integrate and to use our peer services and our peer supports to help more people. That's what the ACA's opened up for us on a practical peer workforce context.
Right, which is very different than what it was originally about.
Agreed. You are both right. This is Gareth. You are both right. It's different. The original movement is no longer the driving force behind what is right now going on with what's called the peer workforce.
I mean, I would say not only are we not the driving force, but we've been essentially kicked out of what is going on with what it was we were initially being responded to, what they created all of this for as a response to the people who were originally communicating with the federal and state governments about the problems that existed, right? Now all of those people are kicked out. Because many of them are still alive, right? I'm not talking about myself. I wasn't there. I wasn't alive. I mean, I was alive at the point, but I wasn't there. I was just getting locked up as 3 years after this big shift in the movement. I had gotten locked up, so it wasn't. It's these other people, but they're still alive, and they're still. Many of them are still fighting to try to get a word in edgewise back to the original goals of the movement. And, like, when we read the Declaration of Principles, the 1982 Declaration of Principles, like, that was what the federal government and wanted to shut down. But that was the messaging, and it's been successfully rooted out. And I think that that's part of the problem, because if we were doing what was in the Declaration of Principles, many of the issues I think that we are up against would be gone already.
Well, agreed. And I want to mention something about Georgia. Georgia is one of the states that has been most advanced in getting what we call peers integrated into the system. And Just a point of interest, in 2005, the American Psychiatric Association held their annual convention in Atlanta, and I was living in Atlanta at the time, and I expected it to be quite a hotbed of protest and activism, but there was, and I made a lot of effort to see, you know, put feelers out and talk to people and try to figure out who was going to be down there protesting downtown Atlanta in 2005, and nobody did, because my analysis of it was that the people in Georgia who would be the natural leaders of protests and demonstrations and confrontations had all got jobs with the state of Georgia.
Well, I got trained in my certified career special certification in the state of Texas with DBSA National, Depression Bipolar Support Alliance National, you know, been, you know, led by, you know, Larry Ricks and Ike Powell and Ben Filson, one of my trainers. Larry was there for the first day, and, you know, I remember meeting him, seeing him. He didn't talk to me. I didn't talk to him. And he was sitting in his chair, and I walked in the training room over at Austin Travis Kennedy Care in Austin, you know, and I was like, what the fuck is this? You know, that was my attitude. But I heard, but somebody told me, hey, you can get a job if you take this training. And I needed a job. So I took it and saw this guy sitting in the chair, and Sam Shore approached me and said, oh, you got to take the class. That's fantastic. And I said, yeah, I had to ask my father for the $950 to take the class. And then Larry heard me, and he just kind of looked at me and looked away really fast. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, but it was a good class, and it changed my life. It got me into recovery, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, likewise, when I had the training, it was life-changing and just revolutionary and amazing. And I had not known anything about any of the movements that Lauren speaks of. I didn't know a thing about it until I went to the CPS training, and that's where we started reading Pat Deegan and hearing about Howie the Harp and learning about these people who had come before us. Anyway, I'm terribly conflicted and complex about the whole thing, but in a way it was just really absolutely a wonderful experience, but also it was kind of disillusioning to see how, in a way, we were being co-opted and bought out.
In what way?
Well, like I was talking about the Psychiatry Association, you know, people did not get out there and protest in independent voices or did not speak out against practices by the government in the state of Georgia because they had jobs with the state of Georgia and felt that their livelihood depended on cooperating with their employers.
Right. Okay. Well, the essential, so we come full circle back to the essential original problem that people aren't allowed to speak out against this. What Lauren Mosier yesterday was starting off talking about the American Psychopharmacological Association instead of the Psychiatric Association, and that even at that level, if anybody speaks out against it, then they're, you know, silenced or barred or whatever. And so I think that this remains such a huge problem, but the idea that the federal government is putting out, and NASHBID particularly, is putting out this goal. The National Association, this is who these people are who put this out. The National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, NASHBID, represents state executives responsible for the $37.6 billion public mental health service delivery system, serving 7.1 million people annually in all 50 states, 4 territories, and the District of Columbia. NASHBID operates under a cooperative agreement with the National Governors Association. So this is who these people are. These people are, and they are advocating for maintaining institutions.
Can I tell you something? What NASHBID did for me when I was in Texas, they came free of charge to provide assistance to a place I was working at in DFW in Dallas-Fort Worth,
but they came to provide technical assistance to help that organization that I worked for become trauma-informed care recovery foundationally. And they came on their own dime. And it was good, and it helped a lot of people in the community. And since then, it's spread like wildfire through the entire Tarrant County providership. So I'm grateful to NASHPID. I mean, and I've also contacted NASHPID for North Carolina and now for Georgia, and it's going to happen. So I have no qualms with NASHPID. I'm grateful for NASHPID.
NASHPID isn't the problem. The report that they're endorsing is the problem. I mean, and NASHPID has done a lot of good things. And quite frankly, Bob Glover was one of the first people I ever met. And probably without him, I don't know that I would, would have at that point in my life had maintained where the Youth Empowerment Association was. It's not about the people or the other things, but NASHPID is out promoting the continued use of state institutions. And in 2014, that is a problematic thing in my mind to be promoting. We're supposed to be shutting institutions down, not putting out reports about why we need them and how, quote-unquote, peers, who could be minimally working there for a year before they're certified, keep us in the institution longer. I mean, I guess that's what I was talking about before when I said, isn't anybody, appalled by this? The idea of, being mandated to be at a psychiatric institution on a daily basis where you're there as a quote-unquote peer, as a target for being reinstitutionalized, but they're not calling for more, they're calling to maintain and enhance what they have.
Right. Yeah. I see your point. I get it. But they're friends of mine. And if that places me on the wrong side of the line, then I guess so be it. Can I bring Gareth in here for a sec? I love your post this morning about abolitionists and reformists. And I know where I stand. I know the people that know me know where I stand, And, I guess it's just it all comes back down to, being authentic to yourself and to the community. And, I know what you're saying about NASHPID and the amount of money that they have and the programs that they support and, through their deliverables and stuff. I hear you. It's rampant and it's systemic at this point. So how do you break it?
How do you break what, Jen? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
I said, how do you break the system of doing these harms to continued harms? The organizations that are doing that. I'm not saying all of them are doing it. I'm not saying all are. But those that are, how do you stop how do you change the process?
I think it depends whether you think the system should be just eliminated or improved. I think it should be improved. Now, looking at this report, it says the number of residents in state, they use the word residents, in state psychiatric hospitals declined by 92% from 1950 to 2012. However, state psychiatric hospitals, and this is me talking now, they haven't disappeared, and I don't think that the goal is to eliminate them entirely, or if in a very few cases where they have been eliminated in a jurisdiction, then there are other locked units substitute for the state. So it's been massively reduced, but it's not going to disappear, I don't think.
I just don't know. And I don't know. I mean, when, you started before of abolition or reform, and it's like, well, why would you not, I mean, the psychiatric survivor movement and the alternatives movement have plenty of things that are alternative to psychiatry. And so abolishing the fraud of psychiatry, the misrepresentation, if psychiatry, and I've said this repeatedly, if psychiatry represented itself accurately and removed acceptance of state power, then maybe we would be in a different situation. What if all oncologists all of a sudden tomorrow were able to say, well, if you don't comply with my orders, I'm coming after you with state power and I'm going to lock you up because you're a danger to yourself, and if you don't do what I tell you, you're going to die.
They can do that if you're under 18.
Right, but it's another way of the infantilization of people who are psychiatrically assigned.
Well, I guess there's two dimensions to it. One is what should be right, and the other is what's realistically going to be true. And on those two dimensions, what should be right, should there ever be coercion and force in society, I guess realistically that I believe there is and should be, because a part of our society that I believe is necessary to have coercion and force in society somewhere. I do.
Oh, my goodness. Do you really believe that?
Well, sure. If somebody kills someone, I want them to be confined or...
But we're not talking about somebody killing someone. We're talking about somebody refusing a psychiatric assignment or...
Well, I was talking about in society very generally.
Actually, before that, we were talking about cancer, which does sometimes very often end in death. So,
what does?
Cancer. I was saying, like, if all oncologists were given the power, state power tomorrow and said that, if their patients didn't comply, that they were going to go after them and lock them up and make them comply with the treatment. And Gareth then said they can do that to people under 18, and I said, well, that's how they wind up infantilizing people who have psychiatric histories, and then all of a sudden we're talking about murder or something. So that's where I got a little...
I apologize. I sometimes go on dramatic.
I want to bring in something into our dialogue tonight, and that is for us to talk about the direness of the people that need help in their journey and in their recovery, okay? That live with shared life experience, that are in pain, that are not feeling that great, that are ill, and I think a lot of it has to do with the economy. I think a lot of it has to do with all sorts of socioeconomic and disenfranchised demographic reasons. Like poverty, mental ill health is often associated with poverty, and I think the reason why a lot of providers are running to try to incorporate our supports and our services, whether it's voluntary or paid, is because the need is so great. There are a lot of poor people. There are. Let's face it.
But that's not a psychiatric response. Economics. Somebody not having money should not generate on any level a psychiatric response.
What do you know? These people who are actually living with mental diversity in whatever form and in whatever way they're needing to take care of themselves, they're seeking assistance, and unfortunately they have to go to the local mental health authority, or be in crisis, suicidal or homicidal, in order to get intensive psychiatric attention. And of course, you and I both know
that. But if the problem is
economic,
psychiatry isn't going to fix that. Money is going to fix that.
Yes, money is going to fix that.
So why isn't it that people who are in economic need don't go someplace where they can get money?
That's why I'm talking about the development and leadership of a peer workforce.
That's why I wanted to get the
whole thing I'm talking about. If a person can get a job, a good job that pays more than enough money every month to survive, and do what they want to do, using their story and strength of hope and recovering to help other people that aren't there yet. You know, that's what the whole peer workforce movement is about.
Well, let me tell you, I just don't think that it's developing a peer workforce. I mean, one of the last chapters of the
Z-Boys. It is developing a peer workforce, though.
Because there's a whole world outside of the mental institution where people can have a life and an economic dream. And so it's not about, because what winds up happening is that people need a job, and then they find out that there's this training that they could go to that'll get them a job, and they wind up getting stuck in the psychiatric bubble and never getting
I guess I don't look at it as being quote-unquote stuck. I see it as more of an opportunity to spread love and understanding and hope and help get people out of despair.
I should say that the last chapter of Devoiced was called The Mad Economic Dream Scheme. So I'm not in dispute with you, the meds. I'm not in dispute about the fact that economics is at the base of this problem and that people need to find ways. But this was not putting people into, quote-unquote peer roles. This is not the way to create an out for people back into society. It very often traps them inside of it.
Let me back up here for a moment and say that I don't believe that everybody that experiences what I live with wants to get into peer work. Hell no. God, who would want to do this work? It's so fucking hard. It's hard.
Well, I think beyond being hard, it's a violation. It's a violation to tell people that they are, because very often then what happens, even people who wind up working in these peer roles, that they're told that they're going to be able to go and be amongst their peers, and then they experience a breakdown also because they're not allowed to, and then finding out that their whole job is a farce. And everything that they've been told that they could do, they can't do. And this is routine inside of it, because at the end of the day, I mean, even in peer-run organizations this happens, but certainly if somebody's working in a traditional psychiatric place, the power structure that be, if you are in an outed position as somebody who has a psychiatric history, you are not treated equal to anybody else who works in that organization, and there are very often policies that prevent anybody in the organization who is not working in the Office of Consumer Affairs or is a peer specialist or whatever to have any kind of relationship with you other than strictly work-related. Whereas everybody else who works there is allowed to have whatever kind of relationships with other people that they want. So we're always seen as less than. We're never given basic human status, and the discrimination that is against us in those ways, it's just not the answer. And because the federal government is throwing money at it in states where they've done this, I mean, and they're trying to do it in New York, but this is the people are being used. That's the real shame of what winds up happening inside of peer, positions, is that they wind up getting all of the work that nobody else who works there wants to do, and paid less than anybody else who works there, with less responsibility and less access.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how it is that I can agree so strongly with both of you. I do. I mean, you are both right. The only thing I would take exception to is saying always and never, because I think it's a very individual situation, and that some people experience just a joyful transformation through getting into this work, and other people are used and actually harmed by getting stuck in it. But you're both talking about realities that are very, very true. But the thing that we can't avoid is that the peer workforce is going to be ever stronger and more standardized So I think that's a reality with which to deal.
Right, and exposing it for what it is, I think, is part of what our work is. And unfortunately, I get, I have a lot of friends who do this. Some of my best friends do this, run these organizations. I mean, this is a constant, we're able to overlook each other's perspectives and still be very, very, very close and wonderful and good friends. And we fight about it all the time. But there are people out there who really are winding up suffering from this, and that the movement is suffering greatly because all of these people who are in these positions, and quite frankly, I don't think that the bulk of the people who are in leadership roles share my perspective. The bulk of them are not abolitionists. They are not anti-psychiatry. They are not identifying as psychiatric survivors. They're just not. The overwhelming majority of people who run and work in these organizations are reformers. And they say that people like me aren't credible. And I say it was people like me who got you your job in the first place. And you should be respecting that. So it's a terrible place to be.
Profoundly true. So where do we go from here?
Alternatives to alternatives, I think. I think we need to be doing something to reach all of these people that that the federal government can afford to reach.
Okay, I've got a challenge. I agree with you. I've got a challenge for you, Lauren. You want to accept it?
I'm willing to hear it.
I have a lot of experience.
Bart Lauren.
What's that?
What? I said I have a lot of experience producing conferences and anything that would be on that level. And so when you decide what kind of conference you want to do, I'll produce it for you.
Well, thanks, Jen. I think you know, there's a bunch of us talking, and I don't know, Sharon, are you still out there in this mess? I think that there's a bunch of us talking and who want to come together and who want to do things and even who want to do them just online and make these kinds of things available for people to get another.
Maybe I'll produce a conference. I haven't done one since 2012. I'm kind of bored anyway. So, well, we should talk.
Well, I think that's great, and I think we are talking and we were talking even like the Psych Out conference. There was one in Canada, one in New York. Maybe it's time for another, Psych Out was established in Canada by Bonnie Burstow and others, Shandala Diamond, a lot of people worked on it, Brenda LaFrancois, and they're all, and then we brought it to New York, and it's a conference for organizing resistance against psychiatry, and that resistance has to be one of the biggest pillars of it, in my mind, is holding it accountable to the truth. If it's so invested in, calling itself a science, it should have to represent itself accurately and honestly, and it doesn't. And so I think that that's what one of the main things that we need to organize against. I'd also like to say that I know in the very near future we're going to be scheduling a whole series of shows specific to human rights and what's going on at the international level of work of bringing input into the United Nations and other working groups on the Tina Minkowitz and others will be we'll be scheduling stuff around that, but these kinds of trainings to give people information about something that they're not going to get from the federal government, because apparently even if you're talking about, Murphy just has no, they're using this on every level to try to shut down anything that is not the biomedical model. And I think that that's something that we all need to work against feverishly, because if these things get knocked out as illegitimate, then we're all in real, real trouble. Need I remind anybody about Murphy's little thing about, you know, we think that we're the angel of Gabriel or Jesus or whatever?
I did.
It's a caricature.
I don't know what Murphy said, but I've been that.
It's a caricature.
I was just being realistic. That was me for a while.
But again, the idea that. Again, the idea that this is something that needs to be the reason for somebody being forcibly drugged and institutionalized is, in my mind, what's illegitimate.
Well, that is what happened to me, and I, you know, unlike many others, I'm glad it did happen. I mean, I know that people have different responses, and in my case, it was what I, in retrospect, and at the time, think was the right thing to do.
Well, like I said the other night, I think that those kinds of things can be written into an advance directive. I mean, doing a long sprawl.
Advance directives, don't get me started.
What's that?
I said advance directives, don't get me started. Although, can we talk about something that's just taking what I refer to and live in as the recovery world. Let's talk about RAP, Wellness Recovery Action Plan.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I don't. I think Mary Ellen Copeland has been around for decades and has worked very hard to help many people over the span of her life. But that's about as much as I think about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot about it. But I have a hard time applying it to myself. But I'm a RAP trained facilitator. It seems to help quite a few people. You know, it seems to work for them. But, you know, that kind of stuff just doesn't work for me. But I also have some things that I could, you know, share with regard to the Copeland Center and Mary Ellen Copeland's work and Matt Federici, you know, and quite a few people that work there, and how effective RAP has been in a lot of different ways programmatically. And, you know, I've seen it firsthand in a very, very large-scale project that's successful to this day. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I called and I was going to bitch about that, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't know very much about any of that world. I really just, it just doesn't ever really, I don't really ever have any opportunity to get near that world. So I'm not near it very often. But I'll tell you, you know, I know some, not everything works for everybody, right? And that's part of what is essential and basic to, you know, really having an individualized approach of things. But certainly what worked for me was, on some level, being told that, you know, seeing a flyer that had all of the side effects of lithium on it, and seeing another flyer that listed out all of the side effects of neuroleptic malignant syndrome and tardive dyskinesia, and that kind of really jostled me. And, you know, seeing a flyer that said, you know, electroshock is a crime against humanity on it made me really question things. You know, I've said it before, I don't have popular beliefs. I don't think that we need to be happy. I don't think that, you know, we need to be healthy. I don't think that we need to, like, do anything that we don't want to do. So you know, whatever decisions people make, I think that they should be with informed choice and informed consent. But as long as you're talking about wellness, you're still in a medical model, because wellness is the antonym of illness. And so you haven't moved the model at all.
Let me ask you this. What do you think about the eight dimensions of wellness?
Yeah, like I said, I don't really... I think that if some people find them valuable, some people have created their programs based on them.
Well, let's talk about the value and its worth. I work on the wellness campaign and social inclusion nationwide with SAMHSA. And and Wellness Week is coming up in September 15th through the 21st nationwide. And
usually just walk away at this point.
50 states and all three territories participating.
Yeah,
but
that's okay. All 50 states and they, you know, there's a lot of things that goes on in these countries that is not good. I think that this kind of thing is whatever. That it's whatever. It's just that's what I think about it. That it's just like whatever. Like,
what is your idea of whole health and wellness and self care?
I'm opposed to it. I'm opposed.
Why?
That's my idea, because I don't think it's something the government should be involved with in terms of telling.
Well, don't involve them in your own life. Don't involve them in your personal life.
How?
But if we're going to try to help a lot of people improve their quality of life and giving them health, helping them get their health in whatever way they want to do it, what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with – nothing is wrong with it. And so, like I said, I just say, like, whatever. Like, I don't get involved with it. It's just not in my purview. I could care less about it. I think very often it's a waste. I think very often it's like – you know, basic Psych 100 kind of stuff. It's not anything, the eight dimensions of quote-unquote wellness. It's not anything that, like, if you opened up a basic psychology textbook, wouldn't be, like, every chapter that's discussed. I don't think it's anything groundbreaking, in other words. But I think, as long as you're in a wellness model, you're still operating in a medical model. It's
a word. It's just a word that people are using to describe being well. That's all it is.
I really see how that could be seen. That when you use the term and the concepts of wellness, that you are talking about the antithesis of illness, and that you are therefore referencing and incorporating the medical model. I can kind of see that. I hadn't seen that before just now. But, I mean, Lauren, I think the reason I keep coming back to your show and reading your stuff, because you're just a really amazing, unconventional, radical thinker, and you really get to the truth of things in ways that are very difficult to tolerate, really, because you get to truths of things that are really uncomfortable and radical. So I really appreciate you.
Well, thanks, Garrett. I think that it can be uncomfortable. I mean, you know, Jung was uncomfortable. Carl Jung was uncomfortable. People thought Carl Jung, you know, that he would dare to talk about the fact that, you know, to know the darkness, to be able to understand the darkness in others, one needs to understand the darkness in oneself, right? Like, that we all have this side that nobody wants to deal with. But, but that's real, and it's something that we all experience, and that is something that, you know, doesn't need to be wiped out of us just because you have the idea that, you know, and it also goes back to, like, when I was locked up when I was 15. Well, you're not well, dear. You know what I mean? Like, why do I have to take this? Well, because you're a little bit psychotic, dear. You're not well, dear. You know what I mean? Like, so when I hear wellness, like, that's what I hear. Like, I don't hear, like, whatever it is other people hear. And I know other people hear other stuff. And this is part of the problem of words and language, and that they have, you know, deeper meanings to us. But they do affect the way it goes. because, you know, because if you're not well, you're ill. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Well, I can see that. At the same time, me personally, I really embrace the whole biopsychosocial, quasi-medical, based in the medical. I mean, I'm really fascinated by all that stuff, and I find that it's helpful and explains things. I think a problem I have is my thinking is far too complex, and I become stumped as to what to do.
What to do about what?
Anything. Anything that involves, you know, when I'm really, really interested in something, I overthink it, or maybe I think it, and then I become confused as to what I really want. I think I usually return to being fairly conservative, even though I'm very, very, very attracted to radical thinking and analysis. I am also pretty practical, and like, for example, the Occupy movement, I was very, very attracted to their analysis, but their practical approach didn't work, and so I became disillusioned quite quickly. I want things to be able to work.
So you didn't like that, like, somebody would say what, and then everybody would say what, and then somebody would say what are, and everybody would say what are... What are I'm really an anarchist. I hear that, and people laugh all the time, but anytime I take any kind of, you know, people think I'm so radical or whatever, anytime I take any kind of political test or anything, it says that I'm fairly conservative. And so I really don't see, I mean, I understand that I'm told that what I'm saying is radical, but I don't see it as radical generally. I see it as common sense. Maybe I'm just not common. And so what is common
it's
to
uncommon.
Me?
Uncommon. It's rare. And to me, radical has to do with going to the root of things and, you know, disregarding the box, not being outside the box, but just being without the box. And seeing or sensing things at a very fundamental level.
Right. I mean, here. So, like, emotional wellness on the SAMHSA page, and it's like really, and again, this isn't even anything about SAMHSA. This isn't even anything about Eight Dimensions of Wellness. I've never made a comment about this. I've never, like, it's just like whatever. It's like, ugh, whatever. But when you actually look at it and look at what it says emotional, quote, coping effectively with life and creating satisfying relationships. Like, that's emotional wellness? Well, I don't see how that's emotional wellness. And second of all, satisfying relationships, creating satisfying relationships, like, that's a gift if you can get a relationship that's satisfying. The overwhelming majority of interactions that one has with others in the course of their lifetime, you know, why are we putting people on this? Why are we making people think that this is what is, quote-unquote, well or not ill, being able to have satisfying relationships? People have the ability to experience 7 emotions. 5 of them are negative. Like, why are we putting this kind of pressure on people to put this idea? Financial wellness, satisfaction with current and future financial situations. Are you kidding me? In this economy, in this capitalistic society? Like, why are we doing this to people?
I think isn't that kind of Peggy Swarbrick's thing, introducing the financial wellness? I don't think
yeah.
I've seen that. Is it?
I don't even care who it is.
I love,
I'm just saying in general.
I love Peggy. And as far as the domain of wellness, I think, you know, including economic subsistence and flourishing, it makes sense to me. Should the government be trying to get somebody?
But the idea that financial wellness is satisfaction with current and future financial situations. So if you're not satisfied with your financial situation, you're not going to be well. Like, that is a dangerous statement to make to an American in 2014. Like, and then, like, environmental. Good health by occupying pleasant, stimulating environments that support well-being. Well, if you look at environmental psychology, what they say humans most need is privacy and territoriality and freedom of choice. And that if you don't have privacy and territoriality, then you can't have freedom of choice. And without freedom of choice, that you can't really have a good experience of the environment. But yet we're locking people up in institutions where they're not allowed to have any privacy or sense of territory. Like, it just, again, I would have never talked about this in a million years if you didn't ask me directly, but those are the kinds of things of where it's like, why is this what wellness is?
Well, I haven't paid too much attention to the SAMHSA wellness thing because I, you know, I
guess
I
haven't seen harmless, what?
Harmless.
You haven't seen what, Gareth?
I said I just haven't paid too much attention to the SAMHSA domains of wellness because it's
The SAMHSA domains of wellness, the eight dimensions
of
wellness.
Yeah, it just
well. I use it as a blueprint for me. You know, it really helped me when it first came out. You know, it was like, wow, this is awesome. And no, it's not rocket science, okay? We all know that. But it's good, and it's helped quite a lot of people. And it's also helped initiate everyday wellness awareness now from that campaign. And, that, you know, it's been outstanding. I have no complaints. You know, Wilma Townsend, Peggy Swarbrick, Paolo Delvecchio, bravo.
Yeah. I mean, this all goes to, like, the, you know, prevention crap and all of that, which I just think is more,
well,
more dangerous.
I
mean, the idea...
I don't like prevention.
It just all goes to, you know, recognizing the need for physical activity, diet, sleep, and nutrition. Like, I don't need the government telling me any of this. Like, this is, but, you know, again, I don't have popular beliefs when it comes to where I think the government should be in this conversation.
Well, are you going to buy everybody gym memberships to Gold's?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to buy everybody a gym membership to Gold's?
To buy everybody a gym membership?
To me, it's kind of like, you know, I understand that we're talking about the word wellness and the concept of wellness and the whole idea of it. But, you know, public health has helped people increase their life expectancy already. And, the 2006 report that came out with Parks and Nettleshot and everybody, you know, talking about morbidity and mortality of the 10, 12 states, I mean, studying that paper, I mean, this is all a product of that. We're helping to save lives, whether the word is wellness or prevention.
But again, the idea of quote unquote saving lives, I think is, I don't know. Area code 646,
yeah,
your line is open.
The statistics for people dying of diabetes, and why are people dying of diabetes?
But people are dying from diabetes because the psychiatric drugs are causing diabetes. The psychiatric drugs cause diabetes. So instead of, like, stopping people from having to take these drugs that are causing diabetes, they're telling people that they have to exercise. Like, it's backwards. But please stay online. But area code 646, your line is open.
Hi. Hi, Lauren. It's Les.
Hey, Les.
How you doing?
Good. What do you want to talk about? Jump in.
I think the personal accountability issue becomes big. You know, the reality is the drugs cause real sedation issues. The drugs cause real sedentary issues. The drugs satiate to a point where you want to eat. You want to do this. You want to do that. So don't tell me about, oh, well, let's get folks off the drugs and let's stop handing them a pill for poverty and medicalizing poverty and let's turn around and let people be a little bit accountable for the choices they make. Are you kidding me? Really? Paolo Delvecchio and their ilk, as I call them, are pretty running close with Barbara and Tory and the rest of them. Are you kidding me? See, this is the problem. You want to, it's coercion, just another form of coercion. And that's all voluntarily done. And it's voluntary. Wait, if something works and it's voluntary, and it's voluntarily done, if something works and it's voluntarily done, then by all means, do it. But if you're going to coerce anyone into doing anything, whole different ballgame. Because I heard the tail end of the conversation. And here's what I'm concerned about. This system is an Edmund Fitzgerald. And I'll put the word Edmund Fitzgerald in quotes. And the only ones who have to do the lifting are us. Whether we work in a role as a paid peer specialist or we're the person accessing services. These providers get to sit on their asses and collect $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. Get out of here. Are you kidding me? Really? This is why when it goes back to who trained who and where did you get trained and in the community as an industry, where we're going, it looks very different from state to state.
So you mean the Edmund Fitzgerald that was an American Great Lakes freighter that sank in Lake Superior storm on November 10th, 1975?
Yes.
Thanks, Wikipedia?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Yes, exactly what I think. That's exactly what I think.
Yeah, so we're a freighter that's about to sink. I think it's really complicated, and I think that normally I wouldn't get involved in any of this kind of stuff. The same way I wouldn't, like, get involved with, like, any, like, you know, other stuff of this, you know, whatever. Like, I try to make my point. I generally won't just, if there's a conference going on or something like that and its goal is, like, wellness, I generally just won't go or be involved or do anything about it. Like,
yeah.
Why do I have to be well? I don't want to fucking, I'm sorry, I don't want to be well. Like, why is wellness a goal? And so this is part, I think, of the idea of where it gets really, 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 really uncomfortable for people to have these conversations.
I don't care about wellness. I care about whether or not you've hurt someone else and you've committed a crime. If you've hurt someone else and committed a crime, well, then you need to go to jail. If you've hurt nobody and you haven't committed a crime and you're doing something, no, as long as you understand the consequences of what it is you're doing. Nobody has a right to say squat to you. That's the problem I feel. But once you begin to work in this industry, and this industry is the Edmund Fitzgerald, and you're the one doing all the heavy lifting, well, you know what? At that point, it compromises your, quote-unquote, wellness in so many ways or your recovery. But, see, that's also the other issue. The peer specialists who say, oh, just be doing whatever the provider tells you to do, and everything will be all right. And then there are those of us who say, fuck the provider. You know what? First act of recovery is an act of noncompliance, because that's when you begin to develop your own voice. That's when you begin to tap into who you are and what it is you need. That's why there can be no recovery without rights.
And, well, many of us, again, the idea of recovery, again, is still problematic for many of us. The idea of even talking about anything other than, like, recovering back what was stolen from us. Like, that we're recovering from the iatrogenic effects of what happened to us in these places because of their products and practices. Like, this is... You know,
what are all the P's, Lauren? What are all the P's from the dissertation? Products, practices, policies, procedures. What was it? There was like seven of them, weren't there?
Yeah, there was a whole bunch. And it's not my fault. They all start with P. But the big one, two big ones were pain and profit. And I think that we need to keep on getting back to this issue of that this is profit generating. If they are not going to be able to make any money from you, if they are not going to be able to bill for what it is you're getting, if they are not going to be able to in some way benefit from their interaction with you, you might as well not even exist and are very often let out the door. And so they don't, if we really... One strategy toward really ending forced involvement with psychiatry is to remove all profit from any forced psychiatric practice or procedure or product. And in a capitalist society, you can't do that because we're not, quote-unquote, well. The idea that, like, our society is, quote-unquote, well you know, economically, financially. You know, are Americans satisfied with the current, like, on a macro level, if you were to do, you know, macro wellness of a social, societal wellness? Like, is our society financially, socially, spiritually, occupationally, physically, intellectually, environmentally, or emotionally, quote-unquote, well? Like, I mean, this goes back to, like, Eric Fromm. Like, we're, you know, sane in an insane society. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, you know, why are we pretending that this isn't real? Or, like, you know, the Duke study with the involuntary outpatient commitment saying, yes, it's
right.
True, African-Americans are overrepresented, but this is issues of social society, and, you know, it's just the Office of Mental Health, you know, is no different than the larger society. So institutional structural racism exists, and it's, you know, perfectly legitimate that the Office of Mental Health, that you would find this kind of disparity here, because it exists in the larger society. So, everybody carry on. No problems.
Yes. Yep.
As it is.
And you can't fix these social ills with a pill. No,
and
pill
and
for
so
that.
It's a neoliberal, it's a very neoliberal perspective where we're going to focus on fixing the quote-unquote person, and what really needs to be looked at is the structure. And that's the issue with reform versus abolition, right? Gareth, I don't know if you ever heard the famous Thomas Sowers quote that reform is simply prettifying plantations and slavery cannot be reformed, it can only be abolished. And so from an abolition perspective, that's where I'm coming from, that you can't reform something that is evil, such as slavery. And for people, particularly people who are in state services on Medicaid or Medicare, where BHOs are buying and selling us for the least amount of money, for the least, you know, most amount of services, where it's the slave trade, and we are the slaves, and
there you go.
And that's part of the reality. And I think that we need to be firmly addressing it. But that's just me.
I agree with you. I just don't know how you do address it. I mean, I think that's why understanding that part of what you do if you choose to work in the system is really focus on social justice and social issues like poverty. You know, I just don't think you should. I don't think as a peer working in the industry, you care about whether or not people take their meds, don't take their meds, hear voices, don't hear voices, see things we don't see. It's about whether or not they're going to get through the month when they're living 130% below
but
the poverty.
That is not a psychiatric issue, and that is not
right.
That is not.
That's right, Lauren. It's not. But my point is this: the stress of that. The stress of that is real.
I'm not saying
the stress
of that is not real, but putting people in a position of where they think, where you're telling them that psychiatry is going to fix that, is
right.
That to me is criminal. It's
yes.
Criminal.
Well, that I agree with you. That I agree.
I mean,
with you,
the fact that in the diagnostic statistical manual it says that not being able to meet your economic requirements is grounds for any psychiatric assignment, that's the problem. They should not be allowed to use that, and any economic situation should be resolved prior to being able to, you know, assign somebody one of these, you know, labels.
I agree.
I don't know.
But then it becomes the whole broken brain model theory versus it not being a broken brain model theory and it being about the social circumstances you find yourself in on any given day of the week. You know, that's why, you know, I just, sometimes I look at some of the things that people write and say and I'm like, are you kidding? Really?
I don't know. Sharon, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, Lauren.
What, can you tell me something?
What do you want me to tell you? I'm still kind of like back on, I'm still kind of back on John Allen's letter. That still got me kind of freaked out.
It is.
Loretta, huh? He threaded.
Yeah, it still got
well,
me kind of freaked out. And I really, you know, I wish that John Allen would, like, call in or, you know, respond to one of us in some way and let us know what he meant by that phrase about, God, I don't have it in front of me right now, but it had to do with
perceived injustices.
Real and or perceived injustices.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
John, if you're listening, 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, area code 855-346-3351 after office hours, 855-346-3351.
I mean, really, John, are you saying that our people have issues with our perceptions and that our perceptions are not always correct? Because
well,
that's what it sounds like you're saying.
Real or perceived?
Well, the
I mean,
best is
does
I,
it sound like that I, to anybody else who's on the call?
Well, yeah. I mean,
If I could just interrupt here, I'm just going to read the sentence. It's many of us who have received services from state institutions hold a variety of strong feelings about our experiences. Some good, but many involving real and or perceived injustices in those institutions, which still drive our advocacy efforts today. That said, most of us found...
I can't wait for September's rec, because I'm going to ask him about that line.
I don't know who this guy is. Exactly.
You don't want him.
John Allen is...
anything that I stand for.
I'll tell you what roles I know him to be in. The role that he wrote this letter in was as the president of the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators, and in New York State, he is the director of the Office of Consumer Affairs at the New York State Office of Mental Health, which gives him the right to be part of the group of the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators. So that's, you know.
Well, yeah, I guess I got that.
Very important. He sounds like a very important man.
I guess I got that part. I guess the question I really meant to ask is, who does this man think he is?
I would have to say,
John Allen, if you'd like to call in and explain, because I'm not even going to try to guess. But 267-521-0167, if you'd like to call in. I think that this is a great problem because they're not really representing us, and why would perceived have to be put in that sentence?
Well, it's about to hit the fan because September's rec is coming, and I sure the heck will ask him. You know I will.
Right, but again,
John,
this isn't about, I don't think that this is even about the RAC meeting, Lester. I don't think that this waits for the RAC meeting.
I think we have to,
This is about what his position is on a national level in the United States. This is from his position as the National Association of Consumer Survivor Mental Health Administrators. This is not as his position as the Office of Consumer Affairs in New York.
But I don't
and
know
so,
that we would get an answer from him before September, though, Warren.
Well, I don't think you're going to get an answer from him at the RAC meeting either, and I think that he's going to say that that has nothing to do with this because that's that. But I do think that he needs to answer to why that this is the way it's being promoted in material that supports the continued use and expansion, well, maybe not expansion in terms of beds, but enhancement of what happens in state institutions and an overwhelming onslaught of using quote-unquote peers in these roles. And I do think he should have to answer to it.
Well, I think he should have to answer to it. I agree with that. But I don't know if he knows how many folks have read the report or even sees his letter. That's the key. And then And then, you know, it's just amazing that he would do it.
I don't think that he feels that he answers to the movement anymore. I think he feels that he answers to whoever signs his paycheck.
Well, if that be the case, he has felt that way for a very, very long time.
It really
technically the meeting isn't even ours anymore. It used to be we got to set the agenda for what the office should focus on and what the office should do. We don't even get to do that anymore. It's not even our meeting anymore, really. I call it the John Allen Show.
Well, I think that what the problem is that we, you know, on no level are we being fairly represented by people who are supposed to be representing us in any terms. And the idea that they are putting these places, that these institutions are good things and that they should be brought further in and bring peers further into working in them, instead of eliminating these places, I think it's part of the problem. Somebody's got a lot of background noise on their line. Sorry.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at. Somebody's got a computer, the volume on their computer on, and so got reverb coming back in. Thank you. So I don't know, Jen or Gareth, we have just a little bit of time left. Sharon, if there's anything anybody else wants to say, final thoughts or anything of such.
I like the idea of getting John Stott to be on the show or email him and ask him.
Oh, John Allen. Yeah, I will definitely. I will definitely let him know that there was a request for him to come on the show and talk about this. And I'm sure for anybody who's listening who may be on his Facebook page, maybe you'll just want to let him know also. And Jen, I guess I just want to just say one more thing about your question before, because I wind up very often coming off sounding very cold and heartless about all this kind of stuff, and I'm really not. And I really think that people ought to have every exposure to and opportunity for support and what it is that they need and want and how to go about getting that. I just don't think that we should be having a segregated society called psychiatry delivering and funding and augmenting all of that taxpayer dollars. I think that it should be, I don't think it should be in psychiatry's power to be doing all of that. And I think that when you couple things like education and housing and transportation and food and whatever else into the under the auspices of SAMHSA or psychiatry, that you're segregating us, not you, but that the government is segregating us, and that it's a form of segregation, and that we should be getting these kinds of services from the government the same way everybody else does, and that a psychiatric label should not in any way have anything to do with whether or not you have a place to live or something to eat or go to school or any of that kind of stuff.
I guess because my background is in the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights movement, which when I joined it was a gay rights movement back when, I tend to kind of compare just about everything in my life to that, because that's my life experience. And within the gay movement, there's been people who were just totally, totally radical, and then people who are more reformers, collaborating with the mainstream. And I've always acted really pretty much with the more mainstream reformers, but I have like such an appreciation and awareness of people who are more radical, and I'm always conflicted about that because I don't want to be like using and exploiting the intellectual work and the activism work of people who are laying down in the streets and people who are, you know, electrifying the public with their profound truths. You know, they create, like ACT UP created leverage for the human rights campaign to get more successes on the inside because the people inside the buildings were afraid of those out in the streets. So the people in the streets create success for the people in the buildings, and the people in the streets end up dying and getting run over. And I, you know, it's just a really horrible situation to be involved with when people are dying and getting run over. And I just, I'll never sit easily with the situation at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I hear you. And I think that, you know, quite frankly, there was a point in time in New York where there was a real collaboration between the inside and the outside, and the inside knew that they needed the outside, and the outside was able to put pressure on the inside and get information from the inside to know how to direct things and to be able to move things further along. And when the people on the inside start just referring to the people on the outside as not credible instead of working, you know what I mean? And that's where we're at now, is that the outsiders are, you know, cast out, and the insiders are, you know, selling whatever they can to get whatever pieces they can through, but without that pressure. And I guess, you know, ACT UP mm-hmm. is a group that I've always really admired and you know, and so I think that that's, you know, just where it's at, you know. But I think that that's part of the exact illustration is which part I probably would have been involved with if I was involved at that point.
Well, I'm really choosing to be on the inside, you know, doing the whole licensing and all that. And I intend to stay in touch with people like y'all on this show. I don't think it's responsible to be just talking to each other in the building and not paying attention to what's really going on everywhere.
Well, I think, yeah, I hear you there. Lester, your line is open again.
Yeah, I think though, and I will say that the idea of radical, what do you mean by that? So is rights a radical idea? I think rights is more a mainstream idea. The fact that it's seen as radical by those on the inside, to me, is where it becomes extremely problematic, at least for me, because I work from a rights focus in my work. I don't ever think that, you know, I should come from any other perspective than one that's really about choice and one that's about rights and one that's about what is it in terms of people and their voice. And like Lauren said, trying to recover from what the system took from them. And whether it's years, whether it's days, whether it's months, whether it's weeks, you know, I think those are far more larger issues. And I think that, you know, to think of rights as a radical idea is very problematic.
Well, I'm just, you know, I think that that's part of what it is. And there are some people who do see this as radical. And so I'm just putting on the Talk with Penny Facebook page, which you can find at, I think, facebook.com/talkwithpenny, that there is an official request for John B. Allen Jr. to come on the Talk with Tenny show.
There you go.
And talk about this perceived injustice, eh?
Yeah. Perceived injustice.
And so, you know, I think it'll be really interesting to see where this all goes. I think for sure, and without a doubt, we have been asking people to speak out and to share their perspectives and to try to reach the more mainstream media about our perspectives and to start these dialogues and in those ways, I think that this is very much working. And that to me is exciting, that we're opening up lines here for the possibility for conversation and perhaps conversations that wouldn't have happened before. And, you know, who knows where they'll take us. And so I want to...
I think the conversations are important.
And so I want to really thank you all, I guess, is the point, for continuing to trust the process here and call in and participate and, you know, share your ideas and have these conversations. And, you know, you made me sweat a couple of times tonight. It's kind of hard fighting against, you know, talking up to the man of this, you know, this wellness crap. But I would have never brought it up, Jen. I would have never brought it up.
Why?
The wellness stuff. I would have never gone there. But I do think that these are, you know, the important conversations that we need to have. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, regardless of, like, you know, it's not terribly harmful. It's not, you know, there's nothing like, you know, so egregious there that you have to run and stop everything. It's not like it's a promotion of forced psychiatry. But, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Murphy, that we need to fight against him against, because he wants to shut this place down. I think, quite frankly, that there are people like, you know, me out there shows that SAMHSA really isn't anti-psychiatry, you know, when... And that they shouldn't have that title, you know, Congressman Murphy, Representative Murphy. I think that you are misguided in calling SAMHSA anti-psychiatry. That they are very much still within the medical model of what is going on there. But you know, they and other people like NASHBID with the trauma-informed care are doing a lot of really important things. The fact that you know, language like in the vital role of state psychiatric hospitals report that just came out, that the language is no longer eliminating restraints and seclusion, but has been, you know, reduced down to reducing seclusion and restraint. Like that in itself, like those kinds of little things really are a problem, because the goal used to be to eliminate it. And now our goal is to just reduce it. And for people who are locked up, this is, you know, still very much a problem.
Sitting there with a hypodermic needle in someone's hand saying, I'm going to hit you with it. Yeah, pretty coercive if you ask me. I mean, it's the equivalent of a chemical lobotomy.
Jen, Gareth, Sharon, any final thoughts?
No, I don't. I just want to say thanks a lot. I enjoyed tonight's call. Hope you did too.
I did enjoy it, and I want to thank you for calling in. Sharon, hopefully soon we'll have something a little bit more concrete, alternatives to alternatives, and perhaps Jen will help with organizing such a conference.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. And, Gareth, I look forward to more conversations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, Lester. Yes. And Lester, I'll talk with you soon. Again, if anybody has an idea for a show or a tip or wants to be a guest to talk about something that you're actively working on or that you've done in the past, the Talk with Tenny tip line is area code 718-273-8708. In the very near future, we're going to have another special on electroshock, crime against humanity, and a series of shows on human rights at the international level and ways that people can get involved. So I'm going to thank you all for speaking out and ask you to keep on speaking out. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.